say this. On a day when, for reasons I don't quarrel with at all, a number of churches did not hold a service this Sunday. If you looked at the ticker there on Channel 9 where we put up our announcements, I noticed there were a lot of cancellations, and I can appreciate the reason for doing that. But I just want to say, 16 members of our choir showing up that he's sing for us. Thanks very much. Thank you.
And the band.
And the band. Yes, the band. Good. While you're at it, give the rest of yourselves a hand for being here. And I did write a sermon this past week, so I will... Timing is everything. This particular piece of timing, in more ways than one, really, could not be more exquisite. Tomorrow, we as a nation will observe as a federal holiday the 80th birthday of the late Dr. Martin Luther King. On the following day, we will see sworn into office a President of the United States, a 47-year-old African-American who was 2 years old when Dr. King gave his celebrated I Have a Dream speech and sermon. I count among the many great and many blessings of my life that both of these events have taken place within the course of my life, and that thanks to the medium of television, I was able to witness both of them. The first one at the age of 18, and this next one now at the age of 63. Even during my times of my strongest arguments and disappointments with my country, I've always cherished my citizenship as an American, and over the past several months, I have come to cherish it in even more profound ways. When I set out to work on this sermon, I was going to try to make a kind of an imagined dialogue between Dr. King and President-elect Obama, and I kept trying and just couldn't get it to work. I decided it was way too presumptuous of me to try to get inside of both of their heads. So if you're expecting me to do that, I'm sorry, but I think I figured out another way to make it work anyway. I'm chosen instead to try to look at some of the interplay, some of the touch points between these two amazing lives, and what that interplay might mean for our country, our common life in the days ahead. And since these thoughts are being offered in a religious setting, a liberal religious setting, that's where I'll begin. They were raised in very different ways with respect to their religious upbringings. But at the time, both Dr. King and President Obama each came to have an understanding of the positive role that religion and religious rhetoric can play. I say can play in our national life. Martin Luther King was a preacher's kid. From his earliest days, he was aware of the stature that his father held in the African-American community of Atlanta, Georgia in the 1930s and 40s. Like a lot of young men who will grow into, as they come into adulthood, he had his issues with his father. But it was also largely through his father, Daddy King, as he was affectionately called, that young Martin came to witness what a powerful and sustaining and transformative force spirituality can be, especially in the lives of the dispossessed and of those who were shut out from the corridors of power. And this really was one of the major factors that in time led Dr. King to choose a career in the ministry for himself after he had originally considered seriously choosing a career in law. While Barack Obama attended religious schools at times during his childhood, he was raised in a largely secular setting and for the most part with an absent father. That's what his first book, Dreams My Father, was about, was trying to recover the meaning of his father in his life. Mr. Obama did choose a career in law. And it was by his own account when he became a community organizer on Chicago's South Side that he also became aware of what a powerful force religion and spirituality could be in a positive and transformative way in the lives of individuals in a community. Mr. Obama worked in the South Side of Chicago with an organization similar in some ways to our Granite State Organizing Project, of which we are a member here, kind of a coalition of religious and labor and civic groups that come together around local issues. And it was in the course of doing that that it was revealed to this budding lawyer what Martin Luther King had known from his infancy about how the power of spirituality and the strength of congregations can be harnessed for the greater good, for greater levels of social justice. And it was this awareness that led Mr. Obama to write in his book, The Audacity of Hope, these words. The discomfort of some progressives with any hint of religiosity has often inhibited us from effectively addressing issues in moral terms. If we scrub language of all religious content, we forfeit the imagery and the terminology through which millions of Americans understand both their personal morality and social justice. Then in that same passage, he goes on to refer to Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, which we heard earlier, and Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. And after he refers to those, he goes on to say, they're summoning, they're referring to King and Lincoln, they're summoning of a higher truth helped inspire what seemed impossible and move the nation to embrace a common destiny. I'm someone, as you know, who has spent his entire career as a religious leader and who is now, shall we say, getting into the latter stages of that career. And when I read these words, I'm heartened by them. And I have been in this arena long enough now to also know how that summoning of a higher truth, as our president-elect calls it, can be abused and manipulated in some tragic and horrible ways. It was a smug and self-righteous kind of God is on our side and therefore whatever we do is right kind of mentality that heavily contributed to our launching a war against a country that posed no threat to our national security and sullied our image around the world, leaving, I will add, our new president with the daunting task of restoring that image, a task which I believe he is more than equal to. But, that said, when it comes to the interplay of religion and religious language and spirituality in our civic life as a nation, great care, I think, must be taken, and I'm using an overworked metaphor here, but great care must be taken to not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Dr. King and Barack Obama were instructive in this regard. I'm pleased to see our new president drawing on the wisdom of Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, a politician and a preacher in the best sense of both of those words, to use that interplay of religion and civic life, to use that interplay in a positive and justice-seeking way, and in a way in which I hope will lead us as the nation, Mr. Obama's words again, to embrace a common destiny. Okay, before I leave this point, it's time for one of my sidebars. I wonder, given that he was a minister with such a high public profile himself, I wonder what Martin Luther King would make of the great symbolic status that certain ministers have come to attain in just the preparations for these inaugural events. Several weeks ago, the Obama transition team announced that the inaugural invocation will be given by the Reverend Rick Warren and the benediction by the Reverend Joseph Lowry. Reverend Warren is the minister of the Evangelical Christian Saddleback Church in Los Angeles, California, and I feel safe in saying he has become the most high-profile evangelical minister in America today. Reverend Lowry was one of Dr. King's closest associates during the Civil Rights Movement. He was the co-founder with Martin Luther King of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, through which Reverend King exercised his civil rights leadership. And then, just this past week, it was announced that Reverend Gene Robinson, the Episcopal Bishop of our state, of our Diocese of New Hampshire, and the first openly gay Episcopal clergy person to become a bishop, will deliver the invocation at an inaugural event at the Lincoln Memorial this afternoon with our president-elect in attendance. I hope they have a little better luck with the weather than we are here. Well, now, Reverend Robinson and I, we don't hang out together, but we know each other. Our paths have crossed at various kinds of interfaith events over the last several years. And he is a good friend, family friend, of one of the members of our congregation, so he's quite UU-friendly. I was heartened to see he's planning on giving a more universally-based prayer and not making it a specifically Christian one. I think he's made the right choice on that. Okay, now, I have no desire to turn this sermon into a commentary on three preachers praying, but I don't just want to let it all hang out there either. Many persons in the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community and their supporters and their advocates, of which I consider myself one, were chagrined and rather taken aback with the choice of Reverend Warren. It was not because of his theology, and it was certainly not because of the many good deeds he and his 20,000-member congregation do in attempting to alleviate poverty, disease, and human want around the globe. These are deeds which I, in the main, can admire. But the selection of Reverend Warren came hard on the heels of the prominent role he and his congregation played in the successful passage of a referendum in California, also in the November 4th election, that prohibited same-sex marriage in that state. Whatever the outcome of this referendum, whether it can be rightfully enshrined in law or not, is now in the hands of a court, and that will be decided. Now, I think Mr. Obama is doing the right thing in reaching out to the evangelical community. I think his timing and his placement in this case was not quite so exquisite. I am pleased. President-elect did take a step that needed to be taken in his choice of Gene Robinson to open up the event at the Lincoln Memorial this afternoon. Sidebar to the sidebar, I was also pleased to note, just saw this yesterday, one of the participants in that event this afternoon is one of my personal heroes, Pete Seeger. It's nothing you gotta love. Here was Pete Seeger, who during the 1950s and most of the 1960s was banned from being on television because of his supposed communist affiliations, and now he's singing at a pre-inaugural event. Gotta love it. Yeah. Back to the other thing here. What we are witnessing in this whole matter is the power of symbolism, particularly the power of religious symbolism. And that is something our new president well understands and apparently intends to utilize. In this case, I just feel he didn't quite get the symbols arranged quite right. Now, had this inaugural ceremony planning committee, you see, if they'd asked me to arrange the order of service, something they just somehow, you know, neglected to do, and told me I had to use both the Reverends Warren and Lowry in that service, I first of all would have given the invocation to Reverend Lowry. I think the symbol of one of Dr. King's closest associates offering the invocation of the inauguration of our first African-American president would have been just dynamite. And I would have given the benediction to Reverend Warren as a way of conveying the message that evangelicals do indeed have a place at the table, while also noting that that table sits in a very big tent of faith traditions. A big tent when it comes to the interplay of religion in our civic life. Of course, I wasn't asked, which means that the order of the inaugural ceremony, in the immortal words of Coach Bill Belichick, is what it is. And it's also time for me to move on. Earlier, I made reference to the title of one of Obama's books, The Audacity of Hope. One of my hopes is that our president can also appreciate the paradox of hope. That paradox being that hope is both a very powerful thing and a very extremely fragile thing. It is both incredibly strong and it can be easily broken. And this is something I know Dr. King would certainly have some things to say to Barack Obama about, because he knew about this paradox very well. By the time he had barely reached the age of 30, still amazes me to think about this, especially when I think of some of the stuff I was still doing in my late 20s and early 30s. By the time Dr. King had reached the age of 30, he knew what it was like to have the hopes and aspirations of persons who had felt a profound sense of dispossession for generations vested in him, on his shoulders. And he strove to balance his desire and his calling to give his followers reason to believe in themselves and in what they could attain when it came to the full achievement of racial justice and equality, while also knowing, as Dr. King did, that there would be defeats and disappointments and setbacks that would surely sorely test the hope he was attempting to inspire. The horribly tragic and ultimate setback was, as many of my generation well remember, Dr. King's assassination. I can tell you, it was damned hard to be hopeful about much of anything in the immediate aftershocks of that event. We who felt a close identification with him, we knew that the journey of peace and racial justice had to continue. It was just very hard to take it up again at that very moment. Barack Obama does not confront the same specific set of issues that Dr. King did. And he went a long way in his candidacy for the presidency in bringing in a new generation of voters, many of whom had not previously felt much of an investment in the political process. People, that is to say, who had not previously invested a whole lot of hope in what it is possible to accomplish by things like working to elect candidates to public office or advocating for certain pieces of legislation. This is one major accomplishment to Mr. Obama's credit before he even takes office. The balancing act our incoming president faces them. This is where I feel Dr. King would be instructed. Coming off his amazing campaign, is to offer the kind of hope and belief in the art of the possible that he was so capable of inspiring over the past year or so, while also dealing with the nitty-gritty, back and forth, exercises of political power that are part of any process of governance and are part of a process of using the wheels of government to accomplish good and worthwhile ends. This process, too, brings its disappointments and its setbacks, especially for those of us who wish to see great ends accomplished, especially for those of us who wish to see greater levels of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations achieved, along with the goal of a world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, as our Unitarian Universalist principles so grandly put it. I want to support our new president in achieving such ends, knowing there may well be times when I will be feeling and expressing disappointment as well. The challenges Mr. Obama will face, even as he speaks the last words of his oath of office, are enormous on both the domestic and the global level. You know the list as well as I do. I don't really feel I need to itemize it here. And in meeting those overwhelming challenges, our new president will, I believe, be looking for the right mix of a necessary kind of hopeful rhetoric on the one hand, while also working in the trenches of what can be accomplished on any given day on the other. That was the line that Dr. King had to walk also. This actually sets up my final point, which is about the primary difference between Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. The line from Martin Luther King to Barack Obama is the line from the prophet to the powerful. The prophet in the Judaic tradition, with which I include the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, was the one who purposefully stood outside the corridors of power in order to speak truth to power. And Dr. King stood within and operated within this prophetic tradition throughout his life. He never strove for any kind of public office himself. His role, as he took it on, was to call and to confront and to challenge those who were in power, from the county sheriff to the president of the United States. And when he stood before the Lincoln Memorial on that August day in 1963, with both the White House and the Capitol in his view, and directed his call and his challenge to this nation to, in his words, rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, he was speaking his truth out of that prophetic tradition. He was also speaking the truth of his faith tradition, which happens to be a universal truth as well, and he was speaking all that to the halls of power. He spoke words of judgment about the great unfinished business of racial justice and equality and the seeking of peace, and words of exhortation continue the pursuit of these goals. Nearly 45 years later, thanks in part to much of what Dr. King set in motion, Barack Obama now enters those very halls of power and takes a seat at their highest level. Thanks to the genius of our Constitution, his power is not absolute. One of my hopes for his administration is that he will restore the balance of power of governance that our wise founders intended, that I believe has been seriously eroded in recent 8 years. But balanced as it is, the power Mr. Obama assumes now places him firmly and highly within those same corridors to which Dr. King spoke his prophetic voice. And it is President Barack Obama who will need now to turn his ear to the prophetic voices that will be attempting to speak their truth to him. And I believe that's the main message that Dr. King would give to him. Continue to listen to the prophetic voices just as I was trying to offer them some 40 and 50 years ago, because it was those prophetic voices that were a factor that helped you get to the place where you are today. And so my greatest hope for his administration is that he will continue to hear those voices. Given all this brought Barack Obama to the presidency, I think my hope is well-founded. Time, of course, will tell. My parallel hope is that disregard is that those of us who strive to be persons of faith and hope and love and justice and peace, we will continue to speak our prophetic voices and make them heard. For it is this dialogue, this conversation between power and prophecy has to keep going forward if we are to see the great nation we are still in the process of becoming. Well, the seeds of that greatness are really all around us. We saw some of them this past Thursday afternoon from those who were operating ferry boats and other kinds of water craft, instantaneously realized that whatever they were doing at that moment paled in importance to saving human beings from a fallen airplane in the Hudson River. I guess unless you just got in from Mars, you know that wonderful and miraculous story very well by now. The miracle is one that had to do with the strength and the will of the human spirit, which is one of the greatest miracles there is. And it is the power of the human spirit that I feel is alive and well in our nation. So above and beyond attending to the many and formidable demands of his office, I hope our new president will find ways to nurture those seeds of greatness and those seeds of a generosity of spirit that I think are all over this land. It was, after all, his ability to convince so many of his fellow Americans that those seeds existed in the first place that helped get him elected. So I'm going to close with a story about another one of those seeds. I got this one from Marjorie Egan's column in last Thursday's Boston Herald. And most of you know, when I go looking for some kind of newspaper commentary, I generally tend to cite the more kind of liberal-leaning Boston Globe or New York Times. So in the spirit of true inclusivity, which our new president is striving to demonstrate and urging us to cultivate, I'm going to do my part by citing the more conservative-leaning Boston Herald. I figure we all got to pitch in here, and this is how I'm going to do it. No ideology in this story. Actually, it's just kind of one of those wonderful feel-good kinds of things. In the run-up to the inaugural festivities, one of the Washington, D.C. Marriott hotels offered a $1 million come-to-the-inauguration package that included 300 rooms, 4 suites, and $200,000 in food and drink. A technology tycoon, and that's Miss Egan's characterization, not mine, a technology tycoon named Earl Strafford Sr. bought the whole package and threw in an additional $600,000 for what he wanted to do with it. And what he wanted to do was not throw a self-aggrandizing party for a few hundred of his closest friends. Instead, working through various organizations that attend to the needs of developmentally disabled children, to wounded soldiers, to the terminally ill, to domestic violence survivors, and to the homeless and the chronically unemployed, Mr. Stafford created the People's Inaugural Project. Its aim is to bring persons such as those I just mentioned and those who work with them to the presidential inauguration for a stay at this Marriott, in which they can also see see part of the inaugural. One of the events planned for this occasion is a Martin Luther King luncheon at noon tomorrow, at which one of Dr. King's sons will speak. Ms. Egan's local angle on the story was about some of the people from a Hyannis, Massachusetts-based organization called Cape Abilities that works with children with Down syndrome and who will be sending some of their clients and some of their volunteers to this event. And yes, it's a one-shot thing. And of course, all the challenges, the problems these folks are facing will still be there when it's all over. But they will also have had an experience that none of them could have ever dreamed of by having a part in welcoming our new president into office. There are indeed seeds of hope and generosity amongst us. One of the tasks of leadership, from heading up the humblest organization to being president of the United States, is to tap into the aspirations and the capabilities of those for whom one's leadership is offered. It is to lift up those aspirations and utilize those capabilities in ways that work to the greater common good of all. It is to identify the seeds of hope, and generosity, and sacrifice, and nurture them well. Martin Luther King knew this. I believe Barack Obama knows this as well. What we need to know for ourselves, if we do not already, are the challenges and the commitments we are also ready to take up as our nation enters a new phase in its life.